curious though, just this is a weird way to start off, because I was thinking about this as we were getting on, because this episode's gonna drop May 31st, and apparently it is like Asian like an Islander Pacific Heritage Month, and I didn't even know that existed until a couple years ago. And I'm half Asian myself. Like, did you ever know that that existed?
I mean, I knew it existed, but that's because I was kind of, I've been in the loop, but I mean, I don't place much stock into it, you know? certainly, I mean, yeah, I have mixed feelings about the month, you know? I have mixed feelings about it. I didn't know you were half Asian, though. What ethnicity?
Yeah. Take a guess. I want to see if you can guess it. So I'll tell you what I'm mixed with. I'm half Caucasian, half Asian.
Well, yeah. what's the Caucasian side? How about this? You tell me the Caucasian side.
So mostly British.
Okay. Indian.
Okay, you're not. Well, actually, you are a little bit far.
That wasn't too bad.
Wasn't too bad. So most people actually think I'm like Hispanic. I'm not. I'm actually half Thai.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's. I mean, whatever. They're all the same. I mean, that's good.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said that's pretty good, but yeah.
It's pretty good. Thai is good.
I do have a. Yeah.
It could be worse. It could be better. But. What's weird with Thai jeans that I've noticed, at least, I don't know if this is even an appropriate way to talk about it, but whatever, is that they're pretty watery. That's how I kind of describe them. Like, they just, if you go half with Caucasian and half with Thai, like, they just looks really watered down. But I grew up next to Michigan State University, so we had a large amount of Asian students. And so we had, like, mixed families, so... If you had someone that was like half Chinese and half Caucasian, you could definitely tell. But with like Thai or Cambodian, it's really hard to tell what ethnicity they are. That's what I found, at least.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, well, kind of ish. But hey, no, we're not here to talk about my ethnicity. we are here with Kenny Hsu today, talking about a topic that does not make the rounds a ton. It kind of did briefly in March 2021 when the media decided that it would latch on to this Stop Asian Hate narrative that came from a shooting, which is a whole thing in itself. But Kenny, just want to thank you so much for coming on and just giving us your expertise. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're kind of doing right now in the political and cultural sphere?
Basically, the best way to describe me is an author, political activist. So basically, I wrote a book in 2021 called An Inconvenient Minority, which has surprisingly sold 15,000 copies, a lot of copies. And it's just really about how Asian Americans really inconvenience this narrative of critical race theory, basically, which says America is a racist country. Well, if America is such a racist country, why are they letting Asians get so far ahead of white people? I mean, Asians are like the highest income earning ethnic group in the entire racial group in the entire United States. Racist country wouldn't do that. You know, so either you have to say, well, America prefers Asians, which is definitely not true, especially if you look at the Ivy League discrimination cases where, you know, Asians are accusing Harvard and Chapel Hill of discriminating against them to meet other diversity quotas, other minorities that they want. Or you just have to say, well, you know, hard work, culture, merit actually matters in this country. And the fact is, Asian Americans study 13 hours a week, the average white person studies 8, the average black person studies 5. Those are just facts. So I think culture does really matter in this country. And I think it should disabuse us of the notion that our system is structurally racist.
Yeah. Now let me play some devil's advocate with you. So let's say that I'm like, okay, you know, why are Asians getting ahead? Well, compared to, you know, you mentioned Black Americans. Well, Black Americans have a history of oppression in America, supposed to, well, Asians maybe not as much. What would you say to someone if they brought that argument, which I'm sure there have been people that have brought this argument to you before?
Of course. I would ask them, what do you think contributes more to Black lack of success in this country? Their history of dead people that are dead, or their single parent family rate, 75% single parent family rate, or perhaps their low test scores, their low grades compared to whites, the fact that the racial achievement gap hasn't closed in 40 years. What about the fact that Black Americans, you know, have higher rates of obesity, higher rates of drug use, and higher rates of crime? What do you think really, come on guys, what do you think contributes more to lack of Black success in this country? History or the present?
And, you know, you kind of talking about history in the present too. In the present, what we see, at least what we see in Black America, is a breaking down of the nuclear family. Like, that's a huge, huge part of it. And I've also seen statistics as well that we're seeing a rise in the single white mother, motherhood rate as well. So can you just kind of talk a little bit about, Asian American culture in regards to nuclear family, how does that contribute or not contribute to Asian American success?
Well, the first statistic that I want to draw people to is the study statistic, and I just mentioned it. Asians study twice as many hours as the average American. That matters. Study hours matter because study and practice is how you get better intellectually, which is how you get better scores, which is how, you know, you become a more well-rounded individual, how you become a better employee, how you're able to secure a good job, how you're able to take care of a family. All right, so Asians study pretty hard, and that should be rewarded in our country. It's a meritorious trait for Asians. Another thing is that Asians have a low single-parent family rate. In contrast to Black Americans, where their single-parent family rate is at least 75%, Asian single-parent family rate is less than 15%. So that is important to understand for Asians. And yeah, that's part of our culture. You know, that's part of the immigrant culture, and it's part of the need for immigrants' families to stick together, because you know what Asians don't have? Generational wealth. They don't have so generational wealth. They don't have generational social connections. So you have to make up for it with stable families, because the margin of error is pretty low for Asian Americans. You have to work and you have to have talent to succeed in this country, and Asian Americans do, and they apply those values to their children.
Yeah, no, that's good. And
just going to ask, where do you see that work ethic and that family nucleus coming from that's differentiating Asians from whites or Blacks?
I think first you have to understand, like, the subset of Asians who immigrate to the United States are particularly motivated. So they are seeking opportunity. A lot of Asians in Asia are slackers, of course, you know, but the immigrant subset tends to segregate into, you know, particularly motivated people. Now, these motivated people, you know, adopt certain family traits. For example, the family sticks together. The mother spends a lot of time in the education of the child, especially the mother. The father does too sometimes, but, you know, from reading books to encouraging them to work on math problems, to making sure that if a kid struggles, that they're not just going to be given a free pass. Oh, go get some ice cream, little Johnny. No, you know, stay in your room, figure out the math problem until you're done, so that the Asian American kid can experience the joy of finishing a math problem and have that same burst of dopamine that an average kid would, you know, if they killed 10 people in Call of Duty. So you get that burst of dopamine, and that is sort of the incentive for Asians to continue to study, and it eventually leads to overall greater success educationally.
Is that a cultural difference between Asian families or Asian ethnicity versus whites and Blacks in America that you're seeing?
Yeah, look, I hesitate to say cultural difference, because I don't believe in Asian, like, culture, so to speak, because Asia is a continent of 3 billion people. So that would be a major generalization. But I would say a from my studies that I outline in my book, An Inconvenient Minority, on average, Asian Americans have greater cultural characteristics that result in educational success than whites or blacks.
Okay.
Do you have anything else, Connor?
No, I'll let you keep going.
No, you're good. No, that was a good interjection. I wanted to kind of highlight something that you had said about how Asian Americans, or quite frankly, anyone that works hard and gets good scores should be rewarded for. And I think this is kind of partly where, you know, your work comes in, of kind of asking you and just getting your thoughts on where Asian Americans now stand in the education system. You know, do you think they're being afforded the same opportunities? Do you think that there actually is a certain amount of racism against Asian Americans, whether it could potentially be for the race itself or because they work hard? Can you just kind of unpack that a little bit, and we'll just kind of keep rolling with that?
Yeah. So in addition to the work that I do, the authorship that I do, I also run an organization called Color Us United. And if you go to Color Us United, colorusunited.org, what do we fight for? We fight for no racial preferences in society. We fight for a race-blind society, actually. We believe that companies should not be using DEI policies to divide companies and train them in various sort of race-related things to make people see race, to hate color blindness, and to promote and hire on the basis of race. We don't believe in any of that stuff. We want to take race out of the equation. And one of the reasons why I'm particularly passionate about this issue, if you go on my bio, if you go to colorusunited.org and you look me up, you see that I've been majorly involved with this thing called the Harvard discrimination case. And this is a case that's now in front of the Supreme Court, where basically a group of Asians are suing Harvard University for having higher standards for Asians to apply to the university and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which is another defendant in this case, compared to blacks and compared to even whites in the Harvard case, but definitely compared to blacks. Actually, an Asian has to score like 273 points, not light. An Asian has to score 273 points higher on the SAT to have the same chance of admission as a black person. An Asian with a 25% chance of admission to Harvard would have a 75% chance if he were Hispanic and a 95% chance of admission if he were black, just because of his skin color, just because he looks different. Like, why do we still live in a society that does this? It's because Harvard really wants racial minorities, but they don't want the Asian minorities. They want the other minorities, the minorities that they think are more beneficial to its holy and righteous DEI cause. And that's why I oppose DEI, because really it's just about preferences for certain races, not all races.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've always been a little bit odd about when it came to the idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, where I didn't become super familiar with it probably until a few years ago, because I didn't care a lot about it before. But when they start throwing that in your face constantly, you know, that's what you hear. And so I'm like, okay, well, diversity, equity, inclusion. For the diversity part, I'm like, oh, yeah, I like diversity. You know, that's fine, cool, whatever. I'm a big believer, though, in diversity of thoughts as well, not just diversity of skin tone or ethnicity. But one of the things that I noticed when ever they would talk about diversity, at least in educational institutions, was that it pretty much was, it was only diversity with Black Americans, if that made sense. Like, there really wasn't, it seems like they were genuinely trying to exclude specific races or ethnicities that didn't fit into their mold.
Yeah, or thought patterns, too. If you were of the sound mind to oppose preferences for blacks in your system, canceled. Like, try criticizing that policy in the university right now. It's like, no, like, look, these people are complete equals in every, I mean, black Americans are complete equals in our university is what they would say. And of course, I believe that black Americans are equal in America in the eyes of the Constitution and in the eyes of God. But if you look at the statistics, they're not equal. in their grades and test scores if they're admitted by affirmative action. I mean, look at Harvard's, look at the law schools, the top law schools' percentage of Black Americans graduating and graduating at the top of their class. Most Black Americans who go to law school graduate at the bottom 25% of their class. This wouldn't make sense under a merit-based system, because under a merit-based system, the only Black Americans that would be admitted are the Black Americans who are fully qualified and could compete at the 50% or higher class. But instead, they're admitted because of affirmative action, so they're graduating at the bottom 25% of their class. By the way, where the least prestigious jobs are, where the jobs that are, while the other, where they're going to get discouraged from law, where they're going to harbor a lot of resentment for their white neighbors, and it is because of these policies.
Yeah, and that's some of the things I've thought so much about this, because it really gets to me. Where, like, imagine if you're a Black American and you don't know whether or not you got into a school because you worked hard or because of the color of your skin. Like, if you go by a merit-based society, that benefits everybody at the end of the day, because whether you're Black, whether you're Hispanic, whether you're Asian, if you're able to get into a med school based purely on your scores and based purely on your merit, then you know that you've earned that spot. And people don't have to have that weird thought that no one ever wants to have of, like, if I have a doctor that's of a certain ethnicity, it's like, well, did they get into the med school because they were a diversity application, if that makes sense. Like, no one wants to have that thought because it seems rather racist. But because you have affirmative action, it almost kind of forces you to have to think about that, when in reality, you don't really want to.
Yeah, and our current campaign with Colorist United is tackling the DEI, the imposition of DEI into medical system, which, if you think about it, the one place where Americans don't want preferences for race is medicine, because, my gosh, you want to make sure the guy cutting you open is the best qualified doctor. You don't care if he's Black, white, or Asian. You just want him to be the most competent doctor. So stop admitting candidates who are lower quality. Stop promoting candidates and doctors who are lower quality. You know, that's just what we want. This is the insanity of racial preferences and DEI, is that it's admitting people who are just shouldn't be admitted. And it's going to hurt all of us, you know, in the name of ideology. Okay, great. Congratulations. You have a diversity doctor. Is this doctor going to be capable of operating on your heart? You know, you want to take that risk? Go ahead, take that risk. I don't.
Right. Well, and that kind of leads us into sort of the next thing that you've done. Kind of talk to us a little bit about UNC Chapel Hill, a little bit of the work that you've done with that. Some pretty significant stuff, if you're able to unpack that for us.
So UNC Chapel Hill, I'll just start off with the headline. UNC Chapel Hill has become the first medical school to renounce their DEI framework. Huge, huge.
Yeah.
And that was because of a campaign led by me, led by Colorist United. You can go to colorustunited.org. You can see the campaign. You can see what we've done. We lobbied the state trustees. We lobbied the state legislature. We generated a social media enthusiasm with these ads. Basically, there's like a Black doctor on these ads, and it says, I don't need DEI to succeed. And it just, you know, got thousands of comments, thousands of shares. I went on the media talking about this and talk radio, really, you know, exposed a lot of the investigation and the materials that they were feeding their medical students in place of real medical knowledge. They were teaching them that the medical system was racist. They were teaching that white doctors harbored unconscious bias, you know, and I don't know about you. If you're an incoming first year doctor and the first thing that you hear in your first year orientation is the medical system is racist, I don't think that's very inspirational towards you wanting to succeed.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
I'm just going to interrupt you. And I'm going to ask a very specific question. So if you can't answer it, it's okay. But when you're talking about these materials, was it just what they were teaching? Like, was it in textbooks? Like, was it in brochures? Like, what was the type of materials that you guys were finding in these programs?
Well, there's a textbook that they call the Social Medicine Reader, where if you read this textbook, it's basically like, we need to talk about racism as a cause of these human disparities in health. Wrong. No. You know, your causes of human and health disparities are based primarily on your genetics, your family behavior, and your choices. Okay. Racism has very little to do with it. Or if there is racism, you know, it's, what are you going to do about it? You know, like, is this racism so bad that it's going to actually affect your health? And if it is, then you need to go complain about that elsewhere, not the medical system. It's not the medical system's job to eradicate racism. It's the medical system's job to take care of your medical problems. So they were learning things like that from the social health disparity reader. And unconscious bias training, they had an unconscious bias seminar that was required of their senior staff, where they basically trained them to not be colorblind, to see race, to basically take it easier on Black patients, when all they're really trying to do is help Black patients. Like, they're not trying to be overly harsh on Black patients, but man, and like, if you have an obesity problem, if you have a behavioral problem, you know, it's a doctor's job to let you know, you know, and it's actually a disservice to the Black patient to not let you know. So those are just a couple examples, I would say.
Great. Okay. Awesome. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but I felt like that would be like something specific that'd be good to talk about. Go ahead and continue on with what you're talking about with Color Us United and UNC Chapel Hill.
So Color Us United, by the way, we have a small staff of like 4 or 5 people. We spent about $100,000 on this campaign, which is very small if you consider that the UNC health system is a $6.3 billion institution. So we spent about $100,000 on this campaign. And, you know, we did, in a letter and dated May 11th, UNC responded to another group, not us, because they didn't want to give us the credit, but fine, whatever. They responded to another group saying, we have not operationalized our DEI framework. We will not operationalize our DEI framework. And, you know, and even if we were to do it, we would have to revise it substantially. So that was the answer we were looking for. But we actually want to go even further with UNC. We want to make sure that they're not conducting their DEI programs anymore. So we're going to send an email to their employees. And then we also want the leader of UNC, Wesley Burks, to publicly admit that DEI is harmful to the practice of medicine, which is true. We want him to admit something that is true. And that's the next phase of our campaign.
That's a really cool thing going on there. Connor, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think as far as DEI goes, we spent a lot of time talking about the diversity and the inclusivity part of it. But as far as the equity part, where they're looking for everybody to have the same type of equality of outcome, what do you see the ramifications of that being? I mean, you've talked a little bit about it in the medical industry, but what are some other industries that you foresee that becoming a primary issue, as it seems that as far as the education goes, instead of trying to help kids that are struggling catch up, they just decide to put a cap on others, like you said, for Asians, putting a cap on them, making it harder for them to progress into schools like Harvard, and then making it easier. So it seems like they're trying to level the playing field, but not by bringing people up. They're just trying to compress everybody into one level. What are some of the potential outcomes that we would see? You mentioned the medical industry. How that would play an effect when you don't have the most qualified person opening you up on an operating table. Where else do you see this playing?
Well, our ideal outcome with medical schools is that we market this victory at UNC and say, you know, UNC renounced their DEI framework. Now let's go to the top 10 medical schools in our country, Harvard, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, Mayo Clinic, say the same thing. Hey guys, UNC admitted this truth. Now, are you going to do it? And are you going to actually do what is your scientific medical responsibility? Or are you just going to continue to dither behind, you know, fake DEI ideology? And so we're going to pose that question and pressure them to give an answer to that. And then I think that if we could get those medical schools in line, then I think we would have achieved a very significant national victory.
Particularly in the medical industry.
Yeah, in the medical industry, because Americans, like, they emotionally understand that they need the most qualified doctor. Like, it's emotional to them. Like, they totally get it. Like, no, don't cut me open with a less than qualified surgeon. The other industry that is, I think, most Americans that I think that we can illustrate this is the airline industry. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to actually illustrate this with race. We want to illustrate this with sex. Now, you know, United Airlines, Delta Airlines, they want to recruit so many women pilots that they're starting to lower the standards for women pilots. Well, here's the problem. The problem is, historically, and after all of this civil rights and after everything, still 90% of the pilots, 95% of the pilots in our country are male. Why? You know, it's because men typically have outliers on the spatial recognition front. They're the ones who are, you know, really interested in math, engineering, spatial recognition. They're the ones who actually gravitate to those professions. And by the way, being a pilot is a pretty hard profession. It's pretty backbreaking at times. So, you know, men tend to congregate to those kinds of things, or at least you're willing to do it more than women. So it's a combination of behavior and preferences, and it's not because of sexism. And so when they're lowering the standards to admit more women, you know, this is dangerous for obvious reasons. You know, I think pilots, people understand that they also want a qualified pilot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have this thing that's happening in America where we have such a desire to make, we have such a focus on trying to make everything even that we lose sight of reality, where like our vision of inclusivity, and by our, I mean mostly the left's vision of inclusivity, has overridden reality, where we're going to get to a point where, you know, we can't, with, I think a good example with this is our military. Like, we can't continue to keep lowering the standards of military. Okay, yes, we have a more diverse military and we can cut these really nice ads about how we have, you know, women in the military and they're doing all these things, but eventually that's going to catch up to us in reality of like, we're not as strong as we used to be, or, you know, the plane isn't being flown the best. We're going to have a horrible story about something like that, or the doctor or the surgeon that's working on you is not as qualified as they should be. So I think what you're doing, Kenny, is smart in the sense where you're targeting one group, which is the medical industry, where everyone, just a lay person, can be like, yeah, I want, like you said, I want a surgeon that can work on me well. And then using that as like, okay, this is where we're going to put our focus. And then, at least in my opinion, if you can win in that area, then they'll start to see some of the similarities with other industries as well. It's like, oh, I actually want someone more qualified in this area too, or that area. I think it serves, and this is very off topic, so I'm not gonna get us on this, but even with, we had Dr. Robert Malone, and he's like, you can't win every battle when it comes to vaccination. He's like, but we care about the kids, so that's where I'm putting my focus. And so I feel like you're doing something very similar. Again, I could be a little off on that, but that was just my own ramblings and my own thoughts there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's, hey, you know, you're on the right track for sure. Yeah, I mean, people, once we get them to see it in one industry, we can get them to see it in any industry. Although I really do believe the majority of Americans are behind us. I mean, what kind of person do you have to be to want a bridge to collapse or an airplane to crash just because you want to admit a certain quota of minorities and women? I mean, that's, you have to be a pretty sick person, I would say.
Yeah. And there is no one, like, no one would ever say, you know, I'm a sick person for wanting diversity. I think it's more of they don't see the reality of it yet. They don't see the consequences, so to speak. And there are a lot of consequences if we continue on the diversity, equity, and inclusion route. Not to mention, you know, when you have a lot of these diversity, equity, and inclusion departments, whether it's in education, whether you have it in the corporate world, it's also a huge money suck as well for that institution or for that corporation. So we could probably be saving ourselves a little bit of money in that regard.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, Connor, you gonna say something?
Yeah, and I was going to ask Kenny here, when do you think that DEI begins to, or when do you think it started to mirror segregation and actual racism?
Now, I think that colleges are already instituting, you know, racially segregated graduations and affinity groups. Basically, they think that Black students need to congregate with other Black students to survive or to succeed, which is not true. I personally know a few Black people, Black students, Black kids, whatever, Black adults now, that did not congregate with mostly Black people, and they were very successful. They've continued to become successful. Now, do I know some Black people that did congregate with Black people and became successful? Sure. But it's by no means a requirement. So I don't know why they're enforcing these affinity spaces or encouraging affinity spaces. Why? What about just letting people congregate with whom they want to congregate with? You know? How about that?
And I've never been able to wrap my mind around how they don't see the resemblance to actual segregation when they start doing Black only universities and Black only graduations and classes. Have you been able to wrap your mind around how that just completely goes under the radar for them? Or do you think they know it and they're still pushing for DEI?
I think the DEI officers understand that fundamentally their careers are at stake. You look at the average university has 35 DEI officers, 35 people in their DEI office. Those are people whose careers, whose pay, very nice pay, $120,000 a year for a chief diversity officer, at least. These are people whose livelihoods are bent upon fomenting the narrative of racism on their campus. So I think that those are the people who are trying to keep it afloat. And I'm their worst nightmare.
That's fair.
So how was it that this initially came to you? I don't think we really talked about the origins too much, but what got you started on this and what had you take this all the way are you part of the lawsuit against Harvard? Are you part of the group?
I'm a board member. I'm a board member. I'm not a plaintiff. I didn't actually apply to Harvard.
Okay. So how did all of this come about for you initially? What decided to get you involved?
Well, I thought it was a really interesting issue, basically. I wasn't super emotionally involved with the Harvard case when it first started, but I thought it was a really interesting issue. And, you know, I was worried about my future as an Asian American living in America and seeing, well, is this discrimination against me in the colleges? Is it going to affect me later on? And the reality is it is through DEI departments. It's going to affect me. It's going to affect white people. It's going to affect Black people. It's just bad for everybody. So I got interested in this issue, from my desire to write about something that I thought was very interesting. And this case is very interesting. You know, this is really like the first time. This is not the first time, but this is a real nationally syndicated story where you see the victims of DEI. DEI proponents like to claim that there are no victims. Yes, there are victims of DEI policies. They are the highly qualified whites and Asians who are excluded from your DEI programs, especially your zero-sum DEI programs. Because if you give preference to one minority, guess what? You're discriminating against the non-preferred minority. You can't get around that. And just seeing all of the lies in this discourse perpetuated about DEI just really got me emotionally involved. And that's what led me to write my book, An Inconvenient Minority, which later became a bestseller, and then start my organization, Color Rush United, which has been doing some amazing things in this space.
Yeah, and we'll make sure that we will link that organization below in our podcast. But I do want to ask you a very specific question, and I kind of hinted at it at the beginning of this episode, where there was a case in 2021. There was unfortunately a shooting, and they tried to attribute this shooting to Asian hate and connecting Asian hate to white supremacy. And the reason why I think this is relevant, one, we are talking about discrimination with Asian Americans, but I found there to be something very interesting about this because I noticed colleges were trying to latch on to this and make a statement. But I found that it was odd that they were saying stop Asian hate, but then there's also discrimination that happens in higher education. Now, I guess I am trying to ask a little bit of a leading question, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that at all. They can be completely opposing to what I'm kind of leading you towards, but I found it to be very interesting, to say the least. Did you ever have any thoughts on that when that happened?
So every day somebody dies in Chicago or Baltimore and gets shot, usually by a person of their same race, but sometimes by a person of a different race. Is it really so difficult to wrap your head around the idea that there may be some racist people in our country, and maybe one of those people is this guy who shot up an Asian spa in 2021. He didn't like Asian people. Okay. Yes, it could have been a racist incident. The guy never posted any anti-Asian manifesto. We don't know much about his intentions. And he did shoot like a Hispanic person along with Asian people. I'm not saying that makes him not a racist. I'm just saying maybe he was a racist, you know. But I hate this idea that this one shooting suddenly means that there is an anti-Asian epidemic in our country. You know, why can't we say there is so much hate going on against the Black community from Black people because of how many Black people are shot in Chicago and Baltimore every day? You know, we can't say that because for some reason those crimes are less hateful and less motivated by race than this one. That doesn't make any sense to me. I think all crimes are hate crimes. I think that we should label it as such. The whole idea of making a crime a hate crime is a very poor label based on my research. And it certainly doesn't mean that there is a white epidemic of violence against Asians in our country. In fact, the statistics show that the interracial violence against Asians are plurality targeted by Blacks or from Blacks.
Yeah, that's what I've read as well, and I think that's a good take overall. And with with things like this or any sort of race situation, it's always an opportunity for the media to try to spin it in some way. And so that's what I was seeing in this particular situation. And since I really haven't actually asked a ton of people about it, because it kind of, it served the left's purpose for half a second. And then, once it didn't serve their purpose anymore, it just kind of left the news cycle. But I felt like there was, what you said there was important of, you can have, Black on Black crime, you can have white on white crime. I've read though, Asian on Asian crime is fairly low from what I've read. But just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, Connor.
On the crime statistics specifically?
No, I was just asking if you had anything, because I was going to ask another thing.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so we've kind of talked a little bit about, specifically how DEI harms Asian Americans. And so I know that our audience is, probably they're not probably all Asian. We probably have a lot of different ethnicities, a lot of different races. Can you just kind of closing us out, just tell us why, if I'm white or if I'm Hispanic or if I'm Black, why should I care about discrimination against Asian Americans?
Because ultimately you want to be treated based on your merits, based on what you can contribute, right? That's what you want. Mm-hmm. Harvard is creating a philosophy that is exactly the opposite of that. They want to treat people based on skin color. They want to treat people based on your background. So much of American history is about people transcending and ascending past their background. If all of us were tethered to our family background, the vast, vast, vast majority of us would be poor substances farmers or factory workers. And maybe a small handful of us would be preachers. And so we're not tethered to our background. And I think that our policies should reflect the fact that people make different choices in life and should be rewarded or punished for those choices. That's just what it is. The Asian American case is important because it shows the skin color reference to the victims of a policy that tries to right the wrongs of history. You know, basically, if we're trying to right the wrongs of your ancestors, we're going to create a real victim here. And the victim is Asian Americans who have nothing to do with, you know, slavery, at least in America. And that's like a pretty common sense observation. Most people know, they're like, yeah, you guys didn't really participate in much of the slavery in America, you know? And so why are we trying to bring Asians in and trying to lump them in with the whites and passing policies that hurt them in the name of helping mm-hmm. Black people and punishing whites? You know, I don't want to be a part of this race war. I just want us to promote people based on colorblind merit-based policies.
Yeah. And what you just said there, your ending statement, Kenny, is so countercultural to the way that young Americans, Gen Z and millennials have been trained to work, where you talked about, throughout this entire conversation, we've talked about merit. And you have a generation that is so obsessed with victimhood. That the idea that you're putting forth, I think that what you're doing is fantastic, but it's also going to take other conservatives and also just other like-minded people, whether classical liberal, you know, whatever it is, that says, I'm done being a victim, like a fake victim, and I want to actually work hard. I want to stop being defined by my bad choices and make better choices. Even if I've been given, you know, a bad lot in life. I think, you know, a lot of people, they make excuses, well, this happened to me and this happened. Some of them are legitimately difficult situations that I can't even begin to comprehend. But as a culture, too, one thing that hasn't changed, that we enjoy a good hero rising from the ashes type story. Like, those are the people that we truly admire, that came from nothing and became something. And so I still think that there is some of that still inside of the Gen Z and millennial generation, but they got to snap out of this idea that they're a victim and they have to be defined by their past.
Thank you. That's what I believe too, 100%. I believe you're not a victim. Okay. I believe that there is a lot of opportunity in this country, but you have to go out and claim it for yourself. I believe that teaching people that America is a racist country only flattens them and harms their ability to see the opportunity around them. And that's what I believe. And that's in part stemming from my values, in part stemming from my family, but really in part stemming from reason and logic. How do you get to be the richest country in the world if you don't have people who are productive? That doesn't make any sense, you know? Even if you believe the whole like lie that, well, America did it through colonialism and conquest, well, they had to be good enough to colonize and conquer other people, right?
Right.
So yeah, we are a very productive nation at the very least, and we should continue to abide by those rules.
Yeah, or else we're gonna lose America pretty dang fast, which is an entirely different conversation in itself. Mm-hmm. But Connor, do you have anything that you would like to add?
No, maybe just some of my own comments on meritocracy, and I think similar to you two, I don't want a system that grades me based on the skin of the color of my skin or my ethnicity or whatever my history is. I mean, you got Jordan, obviously, part Asian, part white, myself, part white, part Hispanic and Native American. I don't see an end point for what DEI is proposing. I don't see the results to be better than what a meritocracy system brings us. And, you know, anybody that's listening, I would encourage them to really think about if they want to be, you know, not even just getting into schools, but getting jobs, getting raises, getting promotions. Do you really want to go through your life because of something you can't control and you're just being graded by the shade of color that's on your skin? Or do you want to advance in life because of the work that you produce and the studying that you put in? I don't see how DEI is going to come out with a better system than what we have had in the past. So I think this is kind of just my final comments on it. But honestly, Kenny, what you're doing is fantastic. Tackling a case with Harvard and all these other Ivy League schools is amazing. We'll definitely want to keep following it and see how everything proceeds. Where can people pick up your book, An Inconvenient Minority?
Yeah, you can get it wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. You can get it on IndieBound. I have a new book coming out. Mm-hmm. We didn't get a chance to discuss it, but, you know, I haven't really started promoting it yet. But if you really want to know the truth about why Black Americans have a lower achievement than whites, and it is true, then you need to read my next book, because it's not about racism. It's about a few different things. It's about family ideas, and it's about bad policies. It's about the school system and what they're teaching. It's about all of those things. And so you need to read my next book, School of Woke. And that's going to come out on August 1st.
Awesome. Can people pre-order it?
Yep, you can pre-order it right now. Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Perfect. Okay, perfect. I was asking because we'll also put that in the description as well, so people can do that. But Kenny, once again, thank you so much for your time. For our audience, we will make sure we put all of his links down below. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you can find some really cool interviews along with this one of Kenny Hsu. So until next time, thank you so much for watching or listening, whichever one you're doing, and we'll see you next time.
Cool.
Perfect. Thank you, Kenny.
Thanks.